From CAFE, this is United Security. I'm Lisa Monaco.
And I'm Ken Weinstein.
Morning, Ken Weinstein.
Good morning. Good to see you, Lisa.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Yeah?
Moving into the early days of fall, missing summer.
I know, it's been great. The last couple mornings, it's felt fall-like. Which is kind of a pleasant change.
Fall is in the air. I don't wake up sweating and, dealing with the humidity of D.C. And there's actually football coming. Football is here. So fall is officially here. In fact, it's a little bit like the world is turned upside down because here in D.C., we have the World Championship Nationals who, you know, won the World Series last year and now are sort of fading into oblivion with a very subpar year. And then the Washington football team that, you know, lost its starting quarterback, lost its name, lost its Hall of Fame running back, just pummeled the Philadelphia Eagles in the first game of the season. So go figure.
That's a great recap for the kind of week in sports.
Isn't that what this program is?
Yeah, I really hope the ESPN folks don't get worried that you're coming for them. Right? You're going to be pose a big challenge.
I've got a future in sports.
So we won't be talking anymore about football. But we have got lots to cover today. It feels a little bit, Ken, like it's all Russia all the time with what we've got to talk about today.
Mm-hmm. But it also indicates what kind of threat Russia is. And I think one of the themes that we're going to talk about today is that Russia is Russia, but sort of go back to that old Beatles song, Back to the USSR in some ways.
Back in the U.S., back in the U.S., back in the USSR.
We're seeing, you know, many parallels between what's going on now and what went on back in the days of the Soviet Empire. Same kind of repressive tactics within their country, same kind of efforts to rein in satellite states and develop satellite states. Same kind of reflexive efforts against us and Western Europeans' efforts to spread democracy. So I think it's worth a broadcast all to itself.
Well, you're showing your full range here, Ken, between football commentary and now, you know, Beatles references. So I think let's just get straight into it. I mean, the first thing I think we need to talk about is what's been going on with this poisoning of a Russian opposition leader, Alexei Navalny. The whole story, Ken, is like right out of a Cold War spy novel. So I think we should first step back and figure out kind of how did we get here? And more to the point, how did Navalny get to Germany? You know, so maybe we should just lay down some of the facts. I think, you know, it starts on August 20th, right? So almost a month ago, where this Russian opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, was seemed to have been poisoned in Siberia. And he was in Siberia. They are kind of organizing candidates to run in local elections. And he was traveling from Siberia back to Moscow. And he got violently ill on the plane as he was traveling from Siberia to Moscow, so ill that plane had to make an emergency landing. And the new news is that we're learning, again, this comes from Navalny's own Instagram account, his own posting there. We're learning that he may have been poisoned while he was at his hotel in Siberia. And it includes a discovery that the water bottle he was using may have been laced with this poison. And that comes from evidence that was gathered by his own team, his own lawyers and legal team that was with him in Siberia. They rushed. It's really quite dramatic. It sounds like they rushed to the hotel to gather up evidence after he got really sick on this plane. And so they rushed to the hotel where he'd been staying to grab up this evidence. And ultimately, they took it with them to Germany where it got tested. So this is really a story that has had many twists and turns just over the last couple of weeks. And it also, as you said at the outset, it's got some eerie parallels to some recent events.
Yeah, as you say, right out of a John le Carré Cold War spy novel. You know, he's, as you said, he's in the Siberian city of Tomsk, and he is taking a flight back after having done some political mobilizing and trying to generate the vote for the opposition in Tomsk. Gets on the airplane, collapses, obviously feels like something has been introduced into the system. The airplane then makes an emergency landing in Omsk, So that was a flight from Tomsk to Omsk.
So if this weren't so like dangerous and deadly serious, it would be amusing, that little play on words that you just made. But obviously, yeah, no, appreciate that.
Bad taste, but I couldn't resist. So they get him out in Omsk, and the reports initially are that the Russian doctors there are sort of holding on to him, denying that he has any kind of poison in his system, despite the obvious symptoms of serious poisoning. It appears to his people that the doctors are sort of trying to hold on to him until the poison can take full effect and kill him. Speculation, but that's the what they read into that. Eventually, they relent and allow Navalny to be released, but only after his wife appeals to Putin directly in a public letter asking for him to be released. He gets released to an NGO, this group called Cinema for Peace Foundation, that flies an airplane in, charters a plane, picks him up, and takes him to Germany, where German doctors start to take care of him. And they immediately diagnose it as likely poisoning. They start giving him treatment, and they save his life. But for that NGO flying in there and pulling him out, and the public pressure on Putin to allow him to be released and to leave the country, he probably would be dead today.
Yeah, so let's talk about first, like, who is Navalny, and then talk about some of these, what are, I think, fascinating, dangerous parallels, because this whole thing fits a pattern of Russian behavior against dissident voices, against opposition figures, especially those like Navalny who have gained traction and who have gained a substantial following. So let's just get some facts out on the table about who Navalny is. He's, as you know, we've said, he's a prominent opposition leader, and he's been very, very visible. He's led protests in the past over disputed elections. He's been a fierce critic of Putin. He's called Putin the leader of a party of crooks and thieves. So he's not mincing any words. And he's posed a real thorn in the side of Putin, frankly, and of his cronies. And he's gained a real following over the years. He mounted a campaign and an effort for mayor of Moscow once in the past. He's got this YouTube channel that he set up with about 4 million subscribers when he launched it. And the whole purpose of that YouTube channel has been to expose corruption in the Russian government by Putin, by his cronies. And so he's really cut quite a figure for himself in Russia and gained a real following, such that he has been the subject of repeated attempts to silence him. So this isn't the first time that he has had some bad luck, you know, to put it mildly, when it comes to things he's ingested. And he's found himself on the wrong end of a few events, which have lots of parallels with efforts by the government to silence him.
Yeah, and he is seen as a particular threat to the Kremlin because, as you said, he's focused on corruption. In fact, that's sort of how he got his start back, you know, and he's only in his 40s now. And he started, sort of rose to prominence back in the late 00s, around 2008. And his MO at that point was to get himself in as a minority shareholder in oil companies and other businesses that were hooked in to the Kremlin and that were engaged in corruption, and to start asking questions. And he could do that as a minority shareholder and start pulling out information about the corrupt relationships between these businesses and the government, started to disclose that, as you say, on social media, took advantage of the you know, social media coming to the fore, really appealed to the youth and started building up a following. And his focus on corruption has really been his calling card. And gosh knows, there's lots of corruption around Putin and the Kremlin. And so that obviously was a direct threat to the oligarchy and to Putin. And on two occasions in the past, he's had these mysterious maladies that he thought were, you know, possible poisoning efforts. One, he ended up sort of mysteriously having this allergic reaction of a type he'd never had before. Face swelled up and it was very extreme. He was never able to ascertain what it was, but that was his speculation at the time. And another time, somebody threw some green liquid in his face that really damaged his eye. You know, who knows who was responsible for these incidents, but they're, you know, pretty clearly efforts to intimidate him, if they were, in fact, intentionally introduced into his system. And then, as you pointed out, the government has gone to great lengths to try to diminish him, to try to sort of cause death by a thousand cuts. And to step back for a second, obviously there are different ways that the Kremlin can deal with people like this and have dealt with people like this. But the option or the route that they've opted to take here is to try to disable him. You know, once he got to a point of popularity that, you know, we're really just sending him off to a gulag or whatever would cause more damage than good for the Kremlin, i.e. would generate sympathy and enthusiasm and being rallying call for the opposition, they've decided to instead try to undermine him with the use of the state judicial system. And they brought these various spurious charges against him, ranging from embezzlement to fraud, to accusing him of stealing some piece of street art, to accusing him of defrauding a French perfume company, even saying that he had something to do with killing an elk. All efforts to try to bring charges against him, which would diminish his stature in the public eye, but also disable him from being a candidate. As you pointed out, right after he announced that he was going to run against Putin, lo and behold, charges are lodged against him, which then prevent him from running as a candidate. No coincidence there, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, they literally locked him up so that he couldn't run, right? But to show the force of the figure he's become in Russia, you know, he also got released after there were massive protests that were mobilized. So there's been this kind of dance, it seems, or balance that they've tried to strike, where they try and diminish him, as you said, they try and take him off the field, literally and figuratively, take him off the political field during election times, but also, I think, been a concern about the, you know, the massive kind of outpouring of protest that some of these measures have taken. So, you know, so he's a serious figure. This has gotten a lot of attention. And I think there's a few things that we should all be very concerned about here. One is the repeated efforts, of course, of, you know, the Russian government to try and silence critics. The where this Navalny episode fits within the long history of Russia's efforts to silence opposition figures, and the extreme lengths that they'll go to do that, to the point of using, you know, banned chemical agents on both, it seems in this case, on their own soil against a citizen of their country, but also, as we've seen in the recent past in 2018, against those who have fallen into disfavor in the Kremlin's eyes on foreign soil. And here that's the talking about the case of Sergei Skripal and his daughter, Yulia, who in 2018 were found unconscious in a park in Salisbury, England. And it was determined after a you know, investigation by the Brits into this, that they were poisoned with a nerve agent that was left on their doorknob of their home, of Skripal's home. Now, Skripal, no angel, right? He was a double agent. He was a former GRU, that's the military intelligence arm of the Russian government. He was a former GRU officer, and he turned into a MI6, a British intelligence asset. So he's playing both sides, right? And fallen into disfavor with the Kremlin. And he was in the UK in 2018 after having been traded in a spy swap with Russia. So clearly Russia was exacting revenge with this effort to poison him. And they were doing so in a very noisy and public way, right? They sent agents from Russia to the UK. Those guys used Russian passports and were caught on CCTV twice while they were walking around in Salisbury before they conducted this operation. So it's clear that the Russians wanted to make it known that they had the capability to do this. They did this against Skripal and his daughter and used what was then found to be this nerve agent called Novichok, which turns out to be very similar, if not in the same nerve agent family, as that which has now been found by the doctors in the system of Navalny while he's been in Berlin. Yeah.
It was developed by scientists under the Soviet Union, and they had a stockpile of it. And so we know that the Russian state would have access to it. So Skripal is a great example. I think the amazing aspect of that, well, there are many amazing aspects, but one is that he actually went over to the UK with a spy in as part of a spy swap. So we swapped somebody to the Russians that they wanted to protect. We got him, or the Brits got him, so that they could protect him. And then the Russians come around afterwards and try to kill the guy. It's really not cricket.
No, it's not cricket. Nice. Nice use of the British phrase. No, but it's incredibly brazen, right? So it just shows more and more the lengths to which the Russians will go to kind of exert their power, to exert their influence. We'll talk more about that when we talk about the situation in Belarus in a minute. But so that's obviously one of the things that I think we should all be very, very concerned about in this Navalny episode. But, you know, we should also discuss the whodunit factor here, right? We know that Navalny's got a bunch of opponents in Russia, up to and including Putin. So kind of in the mystery element of this, who do you think done it?
Yeah, well, look, to answer that question, you have to go back and look at the background that we just discussed. You know, not only do we have the poisoning, but we have this whole record of the Russian state ginning up investigations and prosecutions to try to just disable him as an opposition candidate, which, you know, when you think about it, would sort of be like President Trump trying to gin up an investigation against his political opponent, Joe Biden. Oh, wait a minute. That sounds vaguely familiar.
Too soon. Too soon.
Sorry. But it really is. It's, you know, a blatant misuse of the state's authority to dispense justice for political reasons. So you have that. That's obviously state action. Then you have this mysterious poisoning right on the heels and in the midst of that state effort to try to disable him as a political opposition leader. So you have to think at first, okay, is it the leader of the current leader of the Russian government, Vladimir Putin? And look, Putin has many, many reasons, and we've talked about him, for wanting Navalny to go away. Putin has shown that he cannot abide real opposition. He cannot abide criticism. Especially criticism from somebody who's as effective as Navalny. And Navalny is truly effective. He is he's a complete package. He's smart. He's energetic. He's personable. He's got sort of an earthy approach to people that make people gravitate to him. He is zeroed in on a topic for which the Kremlin is incredibly vulnerable, i.e. corruption. And that's something that the people of Russia, going back to the days when they rebelled against the Tsar with the Russian Revolution, the Russian people are sensitive to. He seems to be uncorruptible himself, which is a rarity. And, you know, he's internationalist in his approach. He's talking about the plight of other persecuted people like in Belarus, et cetera. And so he's incredibly famous, and that sort of makes him seemingly untouchable. And as Putin looks up, out across the political landscape, as he's nearing the end of his time, you know, I think he and his people are getting more and more, or feeling more and more insecure, and a threat like this is just something that they would need to deal with. So a lot of reasons why Putin might well have ordered himself. And then just to round out that point, you know, then there's the possibility that Putin didn't order it himself, but Putin has this whole cadre of people around him who are his henchmen, whom he empowers to go do his bidding, whether it's go overseas and try to, send private army members over to Syria to try to effectuate Russian foreign policy objectives, or taking care of dissidents. So he's got this cadre of people. They are enabled. They're enriched by being part of his inner circle. They have an interest in keeping Putin in place. And so they just take it in their own hands. You know, and it sort of takes you back to the Henry II Shakespeare play where, you know, the famous line, "Well, no one rid me of this troublesome priest," where the king, of course, is trying to get rid of Becket. And then sure enough, Becket gets killed by the knights. He didn't order it, but he made it clear.
Can I just comment on the fact we've gone from football to the Beatles to Becket?
I'm a man for all seasons.
I know. It really boggles the mind, I think, your range here. But, you know, look, I think he also, Navalny has proven himself a very dynamic thorn in the side of Putin and his supporters and his underlings. You know, he famously, and I think this is when I was kind of reading about this, I thought it was particularly interesting. He famously used drones to fly over the former prime minister, Dmitry Medvedev, to fly over his estates. Right, to show the kind of opulence and the kind of palatial estate that Medvedev had. And he put those videos on social media and they went viral, just kind of exposing the corruption in the in the Kremlin system. So, you know, it's clear he's probably got enemies beyond Putin, to include oligarchs and other friends of Putin. Also to include, he's gotten on the wrong side of the oligarch who has financed the Internet Research Agency, right? That's the name of the troll farm that the Mueller investigation found was the origin of a lot of the disinformation campaigns on social media that sought to disrupt our elections here in 2016. So he's got a lot of people who he's made angry. But, you know, we should talk about the response to all of this. And that's the other thing, I think.
Oh, but first, I got to cite one thing.
Another Shakespeare reference?
No, this one's a little more earthy. This is Putin's former bodyguard, Viktor Zolotov. He actually challenged Navalny to a duel. Yeah. Which is great.
Pistols at dawn.
Yeah, the 18th century. And he said that he asked Navalny to take him up on a personal combat duel and that they would step into the ring on the judo mat. And I'm quoting here, "And I promise to make juicy, tenderized meat out of you."
God.
Close quote. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
So you're right. So Navalny has lots of enemies who are highly placed in the Kremlin and around the Kremlin, who might well have taken it upon themselves to try to neutralize him as a threat to their position.
So I think the other thing we really need to be talking about with all of this and why it's so significant is, frankly, the very different approaches and different responses that the United States has had to this whole episode versus some of our international allies. And even within the United States, there have been different responses, even within the government. So the State Department and senior officials in the State Department have gotten increasingly strong in their reactions and then in their statements. But we've had mixed signals, to put it mildly, coming out of the White House and coming from President Trump. So, you know, as I said, the statements have varied in strength from the State Department. The U.S. ambassador to Russia has called for an investigation by Russia, which I tend to think is fairly meaningless. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo initially expressed his concern, but has gotten more aggressive of late in his statements around this. My reaction, first and foremost, for us calling for a Russian investigation, that feels to me like serious fox henhouse territory, right? I mean, you know, we've now got the confirmed use of this nerve agent. I think there needs to be a considerably more forceful response. And over the last, you know, in the last week or so, we've seen a mounting response from officials in the State Department, particularly Deputy Secretary of State Steve Biegun. But President Trump has been really very, very weak on this, to the point of not even acknowledging that this poisoning occurred.
Yeah, the president's silence has been deafening in a lot of ways. And it's important that even if you have the Secretary of State, Deputy Secretary of State, Ambassador, and others saying the right thing, trying to put pressure on Russia, Russia listens to what the president says. Our allies, the EU countries, are going to listen to what the president says. And he has barely even mentioned it, only in response to questions from reporters, and has gone to great pains to try to avoid pointing the finger at the Russian government.
Well, even his response to reporters has been kind of barely intelligible first, and been incredibly weak to the point of non-existence, right?
I mean, yeah, he deflects attention to China. What about China?
And every other place. I mean, so he was asked in a press briefing on September 4th, he was asked explicitly about the Navalny poisoning. He was asked explicitly about the German conclusion that, in fact, Navalny was indeed poisoned, and he was asked what should be done. And Trump's first response was to question whether, in fact, the poisoning even occurred. Then he had this kind of bizarre, rambling response where he praised himself for being tough on Russia, and then flitted over to his own view of his own good relations with North Korea, and, oh, by the way, the dictator of that country who killed his own half-brother, right?
By poisoning.
Mm-hmm. Mild aside there.
We all make mistakes.
Then he rambles into talking about the Afghanistan war, and he criticizes Germany for negotiating an energy pipeline with Russia. And then he decries the press for even bringing up Russia with him, and manages to work in a criticism and questioning of global warming in that whole response. So, I mean, that was all over. He did everything he could, literally, to not acknowledge that this was going on.
There's nobody been tougher in Russia than I have. We get along. I get along with almost all countries. I get along with North Korea. Remember, we're supposed to be going to war with North Korea. If Hillary got elected, you'd be at war right now with North Korea. That would be a very messy war, a very bad war.
He finally ambled back to the question and says, well, we don't really know what happened. We don't have proof, but it's terrible. But we don't really know what happened. Right? In the meantime, he's got the world's best intelligence community at his fingertips. You think he might ask them, hey, what do you think happened here?
Right. And look, just based on the publicly available facts, it's obvious that this was likely orchestrated by the Russian government at some level, or, as I said earlier, henchmen of the Russian leader. And for the president not to say anything direct about this and to try to go to such great lengths to evade the question says a lot. And it says a lot to Russia and to Putin. And I think empowers Putin to continue this kind of behavior because he sees there's not going to be a response. But keep in mind, this is not isolated, right? I mean, this has been sort of a standard part of the President Trump playbook for a number of years. We remember that he sided with Putin against his own intelligence community on their findings that Russia had intentionally interfered with our election. You know, the Skripal situation, as you said, you know, he expressed doubts in relation to the IC's determination that this was a Russian assassination. And I think he took on the Prime Minister May of Britain on that issue. Recently, there have been reports about how he dismissed and didn't act on these reports that the Russians were paying bounties for the deaths of U.S. servicemen. And, you know, so this is of a kind with these prior incidents. And as some have pointed out, it might even be getting worse because some of the people who used to be around him who were pretty hawkish toward Russia, like John Bolton and Fiona Hill, are no longer around him. And so to the extent that he sees it, it's politically beneficial for him to try to deflect attention away from Russia's misdeeds so that he won't be tarnished by them because of his relationship with Russia. He's got nobody around checking him. And that's very dangerous because once again, Vladimir Putin takes his cues from what the president says and doesn't say.
Yeah, I mean, can we talk for a minute about like what in a normal world might happen when you have this type of international event? I mean, I don't know about your experience, but when I served in the White House as the Homeland Security Advisor, if there were, and there were events like this, I mean, the use by Assad of chemical weapons against his own people comes to mind, right? When those types of international events happen, what has happened in the past and what frankly should happen is the next morning in the president's daily briefing, that first meeting of the day that presidents have historically had with their senior intelligence team, the president should be asking for an assessment. What does our intelligence community think? What's our best thinking on what happened here? What do we think was the reason for it? What were the intentions behind it? How certain are we? And then what can we do working with our allies to make this public, to call this out, to isolate this activity? So share information with our allies, condemn it strongly, work with our allies, with multilateral organizations like the UN, to cause attention on it and to summon a collective response to show that we're not going to tolerate it or we're going to call it out. So, you know, and we should note a version of that did happen in response to the Skripal incident that we talked about that happened in 2018 after the British concluded and, you know, reported to the international community that this was done with this banned chemical weapon, right? The U.S. did join, the Trump administration did join with our allies to condemn that activity, to sanction it, to expel Russian diplomats from the United States, and Russian diplomats were expelled from the UK and other countries. So there was kind of a collective action and a coming together to really condemn this incredible brazen act of the use of a chemical weapon on foreign soil. So, you know, there is some precedent for that happening. And, you know, one wonders what's going on here and, you know, why they can't summon and muster the same organization in response to the Navalny episode. Now, we should note, Pompeo has recently gone further on this. He has called it out. He has joined a statement with the G7, the group of industrialized nations, to really strongly condemn this activity. But as you say, Ken, the Russians and frankly the rest of the international community is watching what our White House says. They're watching what President Trump says, and it's a real mixed message.
Right, and it just highlights the point that we're not on the sidelines. Whether we want to be or not, the United States is a world leader.
Well, we are on the sidelines, unfortunately, but we shouldn't be.
But we can't be. Everybody looks to us to be on the field, and we can't be on the sidelines. On this one, we are. And just to go back to your experience in the White House, I had the same experience. And it was actually quite, heartening once I got there to see whenever there was an incident around the world, our interests were necessarily involved to one degree or another because we are a world leader. And when that happened, there was a process in place where all the cabinet officers who had an equity in that situation would gather and we would consider the response, the immediate response and then the long-term response. And I think back to the example that you just gave to the Mumbai attacks in 2008. And that was terrorists out of Pakistan attacking Mumbai and killing 160, 70 people, horrific attack. And of course, that had sort of multi-layered issues. There was dealing with the, who were the attackers? Why did they do it? How did they do it? How do we bring justice to them? But it was also this tinderbox of a relationship between Pakistan and India. And this could be the match that could set it off, two nuclear powers. So we had to deal with that. So it was the United States stepping in diplomatically, militarily, with our intelligence community to try to diffuse a tense situation, but also to send the message that this is of importance to us and we're going to help, in that case, the two parties deal with it. So the analogy is there. And I think that model is something that we've seen throughout our government service being employed every time something like this happens. My fear is that that's not really happening. And that goes back to one of the themes we've struck in all these broadcasts, which is the importance of what is called the interagency process, having a vibrant, strong process by which all the members of the various, national security related agencies are prepared and ready to step in, work together at a moment's notice to deal with these kinds of situations. I fear that some of the one part of the reason why we are on the sidelines is that process has fallen apart, that it's not as strong as it has been in the past. And as a result, even if the president were inclined to have a strong response, we just don't have the process in place to bring it about, at least not in a timely manner, where we're actually going to have a strong impact on our adversaries in particular, like Russia.
Yeah, and it appears that what we've got is a White House and a State Department that are increasingly at odds on this particular issue, on the issue of Russia. And you've got folks like the Deputy Secretary of State, who's, I think, generally well thought of, Steve Biegun, who's become kind of the point person on Russia. And in the last couple of weeks, he's been doing the type of diplomacy you would expect in response to this situation. He's criticized the Russians for failing to follow through on an investigation or to launch one. He's called out the use of the nerve agent and the use of nerve agents like this anywhere to include on their own territory. He's pushed allies to condemn the poisoning. And, those have been kind of strong statements and actions that are kind of in the mainstream of what you would expect our senior diplomats to be doing. But the problem is those actions are overshadowed and frankly undercut by this silence from the White House. And it gets to the point where it's a real challenge because what are our allies to think? The other thing, Ken, that comes to mind from my experience when I served in the White House is how we responded and worked with the international community to respond to the downing of a Malaysian airline flight that ended up killing 283 passengers. It was a civilian airliner in July 2014. People may recall this. Fell out of the sky in Europe over Ukraine. And it turns out our intelligence and working with the international community, we exposed very quickly the fact that it was downed by a surface-to-air missile, a Russian surface-to-air missile that was seemingly operating out of pro-Russian-controlled territory in the Donbas region. So this was obviously in the context of the Russian annexation of Crimea that had happened and its activity in the Ukraine. So we moved very quickly to declassify the intelligence that our intelligence community had gathered to understand what had happened here and worked with the international community to expose this. And that's the kind of thing that the United States has done historically when faced with such an important international incident that exposes the malign activity of an adversary like Russia.
Right. And then beyond just calling out malign activity by an adversary, there are a number of different options for sanctions and responses that could be used in a situation like this. One that comes to mind, of course, is the Magnitsky Act. And the Magnitsky Act is named for a man by the name of Sergei Magnitsky, who was a Russian lawyer who devoted his life to trying to figure out what kind of graft and corruption was going on in the midst of the Russian government. And his reward for that was getting arrested and then being killed. And in response, we passed the Magnitsky Act, which provided for blocking the responsible government officials and related businessmen from entering the United States, froze their assets, and banned them from using the U.S. banking system. And that act then has been more broadly applied to human rights abuses in general. And in fact, it was something that had a little cameo in the whole Mueller situation, because that lawyer who attended a meeting in June 2016 at the Trump Tower from Russia that got a lot of play in this whole investigation, she was there specifically to try to persuade the then candidate Trump to overturn the Magnitsky Act, because it's something that really has gotten under the skin of the Russian oligarchs.
Proving once again that all roads lead back to Trump Tower.
It's the center of the universe. But that's one of the options that's out there. And in fact, you all invoked that, did you not? In January 2017, I believe, after it was determined that the Russians were responsible for the poisoning of Litvinenko.
Right.
I think that was right as you guys were leaving the White House, right? As along with the sanctions that were applied for the election interference.
That's exactly right. And, again, this is that Litvinenko poisoning was something that, it took about 10 years for the British to, conduct an inquiry, conclude that this guy Litvinenko was poisoned while he was at a London hotel, and was poisoned, they determined, by the Russians. Ended up, that conclusion was made, the British released its report. And literally in the waning days of the Obama administration, there were sanctions levied under the Magnitsky Act against the perpetrators of that poisoning. And that was done also along with the expulsion of 35 Russian diplomats and intelligence officers who are operating here in the United States, the closure of two facilities, Russian facilities here in the United States that were being used as diplomatic cover, but were really operating as intelligence operations and kind of listening posts here in the United States. And all of that was done on the heels of and in response to the attack on our election in 2016, as well as other Russian aggression against our people, many of our diplomats and others in Russia. So, we've used that Magnitsky Act before and other sanctions, the election interference sanctions that we put in place for malicious cyber activity. Those are the types of tools that we have used in the past to try and respond to this type of activity. We should also, by the way, Ken, put in a plug on the Magnitsky Act, because it featured prominently in an episode of Stay Tuned, right? Preet had a great interview with Bill Browder, who is the individual here in the United States who had hired Sergei Magnitsky to do the work that ultimately ended up getting him this attention and throwing him in prison, where he unfortunately did die.
Yeah. And then just to move on to other areas by which we could force the Russians to pay a penalty, there's a whole regime, we won't get into the details, but a whole regime under the Chemical and Biological Weapons Act and the Chemical Weapons Convention by which we can hold the country to account for their use of chemical weapons. And in fact, the Trump administration did exactly that after it was determined that the Russians were responsible for the Skripal poisoning. And that resulted in, I think, a number of countries, 26 different countries, expelling over 150 Russian diplomats. And we expelled 60 of them, of the Russian diplomats who we thought were intelligence operatives, and then closed the Russian consulate in Seattle, all as a sanction growing out of the finding under that legislation that Russia was responsible for the use of that chemical weapon. So there is a regime that can be resorted to, that has been resorted to, including by this administration, and it's very effective, and it's something that sends a message. So my hope is that ultimately we'll see something like that grow out of the Navalny situation as well.
And there's going to be mounting pressure to have exactly that. I mean, I noticed that there's been a bipartisan call now from members in the House to the White House to use some of these tools, most recently from two members, a Democrat and a Republican from the House of Representatives. So more to come on this.
And one of the key questions here in deciding what kind of response we should make is, you know, why did the Russians do this now? Why poison Navalny now? I mean, this guy has been out there since 2008. He's been gaining steam and is has a real following. And, you know, up to now, except for those two weird situations where they might have tried to poison him before, why try to kill him now? And some have speculated that maybe it's because he's getting traction. And in fact, the election returns in some of the recent elections show that he, Navalny, and his efforts have really eaten into the electoral results of Putin and his party. But then others have said that maybe this is a matter of Putin looking to what's going on in Belarus right now, having concern that maybe that kind of agitation within Belarus and the demonstrations and expressions of desire for freedom in Belarus could end up bleeding over into Russia, and that maybe that's one of the reasons why he decided to get more aggressive against Navalny. What do you think?
As you said, Ken, I mean, this isn't the first time that Navalny has encountered some, what did you call them, mysterious maladies. But, you know, other smart Kremlin watchers, in addition to yourself, have, you know, said there might be two possible explanations to the timing of this kind of attack on Navalny. One is maybe it's an accident, not the poisoning itself, but the timing of it. In other words, was there kind of an ambitious somebody close in the Kremlin who wasn't maybe given explicit authority, but is, you know, looking to be an overachiever here? The other possible explanation is that the Kremlin and Putin in particular, you know, is seeing these protests happening in Belarus, these massive protests that are, you know, rising up in opposition to the dictator there, Alexander Lukashenko, right, who's been in power for some 26 years, which, by the way, Putin's been in office for 20. So he may think, but for the grace of God, go I, right? And, you know, the people in Belarus have shown that there is, you know, even in their own country, where the institutions there have been so dominated by this autocratic head of their country, Lukashenko, that the people can still rise up and assert some power and express their view that enough is enough. And, you know, if you're an autocrat, whether it's like Lukashenko or Putin, you might be looking around and saying, you know, how else am I going to deal with this except by suppressing and putting down to the point of poisoning the presumptive leader of those uprisings and of that opposition. So I think it would be a mistake not to see these things linked in some way.
Also, I want to say that I appreciate you naming me as a Kremlin watcher, adding to my resume, along with being a professional sports savant and an expert in Shakespeare. Thank you for that. But yeah, it doesn't take a seasoned Kremlin watcher to see the connection here between Putin's efforts to rein in the opposition within his own country and the threat that he sees sort of mirrored in what's going on over in Belarus. And just, you know, just to frame what is happening there in Belarus, it's a country that's right smack dab between Russia and Poland and Western Europe, and it's incredibly strategically important to Russia. It was one of it in the Ukraine back in the Soviet day, where sort of the two of them and Russia were the core of the Soviet Union. Putin and the Russian government feel very strongly that Belarus needs to remain in its sphere of influence and cannot drift toward the West. And obviously, one of the main signs of drifting toward the West is starting to engage in democratic reforms. And so the question is, what is Putin going to do to prevent that from happening? He's got a somewhat of a fraught, tense relationship with Lukashenko, who, as you say, is an old school autocratic dictator. And the early indications are that Putin is playing it in a very crafty way. He's not just sort of taking the old playbook of the Soviets and rolling tanks in to Belarus. He did that with Georgia, you know, and I think he's seen the consequences of that. He did that in Ukraine, and that hasn't turned out so well. So he's trying to be a little craftier, and he's sending media personnel in there to try to control the media, to depict the protesters as agents of foreign influence rather than as Belarusians who are just trying to express their need for independence and freedoms. And he's also sending people in to help, at least reports suggest he's sending people in to help the government not just go in and, you know, do mass arrests, which generates more and more sympathy, but to take out the opposition leaders very surgically, which sort of would be consistent with what he did with Navalny. So this is a developing situation, but the fact that the Russians seem to be inserting themselves more aggressively into what's going on in Belarus, add that to what we've seen Putin or his circle willing to do with Navalny, and it shows that this might be a regime, the Russian regime, that is getting more and more concerned for its security and willing to resort to more and more extreme measures.
You know, Ken, your reference to the actions in Georgia, the former, you know, satellite Soviet state there, reminds me of the other parallels that are relevant here. So just a month ago, Ken, the current president of the Czech Republic, Andrej Babiš, and I hope I haven't really mangled his name, he tweeted about this potential parallel between what's going on in Belarus today and the Russian invasion of then Czechoslovakia in 1968. He tweeted, and I quote, "1968 must not happen again in Belarus. The European Union must act. They must encourage the Belarusians not to be afraid to implement the Velvet Revolution model of November 1989, end quote. So, I mean, really, it's a very stark call out by the current president of the Czech Republic to the history of 1968 and the then Soviet invasion of the neighboring country of Czechoslovakia. And it's really quite a stark point of reference from somebody who likely is feeling it quite acutely in just on the periphery there in Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, and that was a period called the Prague Spring in 1968, where the Czechs tried to step away from Soviet control. They tried to loosen up the constraints on their society, allowed for a resurgence in literary expression that had been repressed, loosened up personal freedoms, and of course the Soviets then moved in and took out the government of the Prague Spring, the new liberalizing government, and put it on a hardliner who remained there. And that Soviet-controlled government remained in place until 1989, which, as you say, was the time of the Velvet Revolution, which is when the Czechs finally cast aside that authoritarian government, and they opted for self-determination. And that was at the same time as the rest of Eastern Europe got released from the bonds of sort of the Soviet Empire. And the Velvet Revolution obviously was a much happier ending than what happened in 1968.
Well, you know, it's interesting because our intrepid historical researchers at CAFE were able to come up with a recording that is now housed in the History Center at the University of Virginia, your alma mater, I might call out. And it's got this fascinating excerpt from a phone call between President Johnson and Nixon about what was going on literally in real time, what was going on in 1968 as the kind of tanks were rolling in to Czechoslovakia. The then Soviet ambassador to the United States alerted President Johnson to the invasion, and he did so at the White House on August 20th, 1968. And the reports are that Johnson, who'd been really following this all very closely, what was happening in Prague, was quite upset when Dobrynin, who was then the Russian ambassador to the United States, told him that the Czech leadership had lost confidence in their leader, Dubček, and that they themselves had ordered the invasion, which of course was not accurate. So it turns out late in the evening on August 20th, when all of these events are unfolding in Czechoslovakia, Johnson, the sitting president in the White House, calls the Republican candidate, the then Republican candidate for president, Richard Nixon, and they talk for over 15 minutes about the invasion and about what Dobrynin had reported to Johnson, and Johnson's kind of confusion about what the U.S. could do about all of this.
At 8 o'clock, the Soviet ambassador came in, having called a short time earlier and said he had an urgent message from Mr. Kosygin.
Yes.
And he read to me a two-page statement, the net of which was that the Soviet and the East Germans and the Poles and others were invading Czechoslovakia in response to requests by the Czech government. He said this was not a matter that affected the United States' national interest.
And then the next day, after that conversation that he had with candidate Nixon, President Johnson went out and gave a public statement about the events in Czechoslovakia, in which he made it very clear that he and the United States were condemning what they were doing in Czechoslovakia.
The tragic news from Czechoslovakia shocks the conscience of the world. The Soviet Union and its allies have invaded a defenseless country to stamp out a resurgence of ordinary human freedom. It is a sad commentary on the communist mind that a sign of liberty in Czechoslovakia is deemed a fundamental threat to the security of the Soviet system.
So in contrast, in November of 1989, we saw then Vice President George H.W. Bush, who had just been elected president himself, you know, praise the reemergence of democratic movements in Prague and elsewhere.
In Washington, President Bush applauded today's developments.
The people of Czechoslovakia have the same aspirations for freedom that others have, and I would expect we'd see further changes there, just as we have seen in Poland, Hungary, and in the German Democratic Republic.
So as we wait to see how Russia responds to the movement underway in Belarus, we'll have to watch and see if, as the current president of the Czech Republic suggests, whether today's events and the current events will look more like 1968 or like 1989.
In the meantime, our hopes and prayers will be with the people of Belarus.
Hear, hear.
Before we go, let's not forget we have an unsung hero that we want to give a shout out for, or heroes in this case. And given the topic today about the use of chemicals and chemical weapons, potentially by a foreign state, I think it's worth talking about the people whose job it is and mission it is to help enforce the various prohibitions against the use of chemical weapons around the world.
Right. So those would be the representatives of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. It's a group that was founded in the late 1990s. As basically being a watchdog for the use of and the misuse of chemical weapons and the kind of evasion of the Chemical Weapons Convention, which is an arms treaty that was signed by about 193 nations, including Russia, I might add. So, you know, this OPCW, this organization, is put in place to ensure transparency and protection and international cooperation around this watchdog function for the misuse of chemical weapons, weapons that have been banned by the international community. So, you know, they do really important work, and they're the type of organization that comes into play when countries and adversaries are using these banned weapons And they've figured prominently in some of the events that we talked about today, from the Skripal poisoning to others. So these folks do really important work to be the watchdogs of the misuse of these types of chemical weapons.
And we'll stay tuned to see their role in the aftermath of the Navalny poisoning, where they're just like they did with the Skripal poisoning. I'm sure they'll play a central role in ascertaining what happened and then focusing on the wrongdoer.
So that's all we've got time for today, Ken. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
And in the meantime, please send us your questions at letters@cafe.com, and we'll do our very best to answer them in our next episode.
Till next time. That's it for this week's episode of the United Security Podcast. Your hosts are Lisa Monaco and Ken Weinstein. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The senior audio producer is David Tatasciore. And the CAFE team is David Kurlander, Nat Wiener, Matthew Billy, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Jake Kaplan, Calvin Lord, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Malley. Our music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Thank you for being a part of the CAFE Insider community.